Back to the Future of AI, a podcast time travel about artificial intelligence in companies and society with AI pioneer Alexander Tam.
Today, we're excited to welcome Jack Ramsey, the visionary founder of Multiply. Multiply is an alternative consultancy that helps its clients prepare for the data-driven world that lies before us all. We're proud to be partnering with Jack and Multiply to bring fresh perspectives to our audience and explore cutting-edge solutions together. Before Jack started Multiply, he worked for over 30 years at Accenture, where he was one of the longest-serving managing directors, with experience across a multitude of industries. Welcome, Jack. We're happy to have you.
Yeah, and we're live. Welcome, Jack, here in Munich, and welcome everybody to a new episode of Back to the Future of AI.
It's great to be back. It's been a few weeks, but it's good to be back. Managed to get a bit of a holiday in between, and I put on a few pounds, and I'm quite concerned because they say the camera adds 10 pounds, and you've got three of them. So
yeah, every time I come back here, they keep adding some new tech. So yeah, thanks that you could make it here. And today we're not talking so much about our partnership, which obviously is growing very well. You're the star today, so I'm very excited to learn a little bit more about your past and also your outlook. A lot of stuff happening at the moment. But before we get into that, let's go back back to the past and learn a little bit about you.
Yeah, so where do I begin? I grew up in Scotland, as you know. I was educated there as well. I first studied mathematics at Heriot-Watt University, which I have to say I absolutely hated. It was three dreadful years of a topic that was very different than it was when I was at school. And I didn't really like it. But in my third year, I got introduced to a topic which was called, I think it was called numerical analysis. Mm-hmm. And it involved using computers to help solve problems that you typically would solve in other ways. So it was things like, how do you calculate the square root of a number? Because I think you know there is no algorithm for that. It has to be calculated. And I started programming and I kind of liked it. And I decided to do a master's degree in IT. Mm-hmm. That was a big new topic, information technology, back in 1985. So I went to Glasgow University and had a great time, really loved it, and then decided to apply for jobs in that field. And unfortunately, it was a very depressed time in Scotland. Margaret Thatcher was making a lot of changes that were impacting remote parts of the British Isles, you could say, and Scotland was massively affected. So I had to leave to go to London and join the company called Logica, mm-hmm. which was fascinating. I was there for 7 years or so. And I was working in the defence division, so I had fantastic projects that were kind of unique. I worked on nuclear warhead assembly, for example, so having to move materials around a factory, and it's a very dangerous thing when you move nuclear material, because if people come together accidentally, the nuclear material notices. That's how a nuclear bomb works. You throw it together quickly and you get a bit of a boom. So that was fun. I worked on counter-terrorism as well for a while, which was my first exposure to artificial intelligence, because mm-hmm. we were using AI there. I also did war gaming, radar modeling, this kind of thing. And that was interesting because I worked on fault-tolerant computers, and that helped me get an assignment in New York. So I was working in New York when I was 23, working on international funds transfer on a Stratus, or IBM System 88, as it was rebadged. That was fascinating. And then after a while, a friend of mine joined Anderson Consulting and persuaded me to come as well. So I was there for 31 years, doing a lot of IT delivery, running big engagements, large systems mainly that didn't use any package software. So if you buy a ticket at the Deutsche Bahn, that's our distribution system, and I was responsible for that project, and I worked on a ton of things there for a long time. I then went into management roles, so I ran the technology business for Accenture between 2009 and 2014 in the DACH region. And then Accenture went digital, and I got a global role, so I had a responsibility for a $6 billion portfolio of solutions and contracts for clients. So that was a team of 50,000 people or so.
$6 billion?
$6 billion, yeah.
Wow.
And 250 managing directors working for me on the solutioning and the delivery, which was tremendous fun. And then I helped set up the technology division of the whole manufacturing sector for Accenture. And then I was asked to pick up a local role, actually, to turn around some problems with the data and AI business. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of attrition. Three managing directors were leaving, and I was to persuade them to stay, which I was able to do, thankfully, and then turn the business around to get growth back and to get profitability back. And that was my foray into data and AI. And I left Accenture last year and got itchy feet very quickly. My good friend Olga Mai and Frank Riemensberger, who used to run the DACH region overall for Accenture, persuaded me to launch Multiply, which has been a phenomenal step. It's been so much fun. And and we finally get to work together because I tried to buy you so many times when I was at Accenture and you never wanted to sell. But now we have a perfect opportunity to work together every day, which I really appreciate.
Sometimes good things take a while to happen. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me, because I didn't know that it was something you mentioned in your early career. Can you still remember what kind of AI you used when you said in the was it counterterrorism?
This was in the late 80s.
Can you still remember that?
The package or the software program?
Well, the algorithm or what kind of...
Well, can I talk about it? I mean, it was... No, I can't really talk about it, to be honest. It's probably still classified as confidential.
Okay, no worries, no worries. But that's interesting because, I mean, you have seen so many different industries and projects and clients. And, I mean, I already feel... I wouldn't say old, but at least seasoned in this industry after 15 years. But so like the fashion, you know, like with the new pants that everybody's wearing. Yeah, reminds me of when I was in this age, like 16 years old or so. Things are coming back. And with AI, I mean, the mathematical fundamentals were developed, I don't know, in 70s-ish, right? So if you compare... the time then and the stuff that you did with algorithms and in IT, if you go back and what did you did at this time, how would you compare this to the more recent developments?
I mean, the toolkits have got much better. Certainly when I mean, for example, when I was working on the terrorism project, that was on a tandem computer, and we didn't even really have a relational database at the time. We just had flat files. They were maybe indexed. They would be indexed, but you had to manage all the things like the referential integrity, all this stuff on your own. So the tools were very rudimentary. I mean, companies like Oracle were just really...
It was more of a craft.
Getting to scale then. About then. Yeah, it was, and everybody, you had to understand the architecture of what was going on inside the machine. That was a very useful thing to learn, because there was so much that I learned then that's still very relevant today. So I remember when I was working, for example, at the Deutsche Bahn, if the guys had a problem with performance of a module or something, they would obviously go and ask Jack, because he's the old man of the sea. He's probably seen it before, and they'd come with COBOL, and I'd look at it and say, well, I don't know, I've never seen COBOL before, but what is this statement doing? So you'd have to learn these really fundamental things, and you had to do a lot of things to make sure systems performed. So it's probably going to sound stupid to you, but when you built a record for a database, you had to always make sure that it was you'd have a buffer at the end just to fill it up to exactly 512 bytes or 1024, because you wouldn't want that the disk would have to read two sectors to get one record out. You had to think about things like this, which today you wouldn't even think about that, because disks are so fast performing today, and all systems are. So the tooling got better. The level of the operating system gets higher and higher, and the amount of stuff that you just get bundled is stuff we had to build back in those days. So you had to get anything.
This is a good or a bad thing? Like, this is because I why I'm asking is that I mean, I could piggyback on a lot of stuff when I started, but I still remember inventing algorithms because there was nothing there. Like my first thesis I did and everything, I had to take a paper and understand the ideas and then put it into the algorithm, alter it to the data that it fits some distributions. And now sometimes I feel today it's just brute force, right? It's just like, you know, have a lot of data, a lot of compute, and somehow, you know, some result would be nice.
Yeah, I mean, it's good in the sense that you can achieve things very quickly now. But does that really take the world forward? Because you know, everybody's got the same competitive advantage, and yes, okay, things might be quicker to build, but you're just going to build more stuff. I think if you look at the downside of it, we should all be very concerned about the amount of electricity the IT industry consumes as a consequence of this, because of course the more processors you're using, the more electricity you're using, and we've reached a stage now where the IT industry produces more carbon dioxide than the aviation industry. And everybody's horrified at the pollution that comes and all the carbon dioxide of the aviation industry, but IT is worse.
So, yeah, and with AI and the huge compute GPUs and data centers, it maybe will not get better, But that's definitely a point. But I also sometimes, I think having a little bit understanding about how a machine actually works would help also with some of the weird ideas. Another guy left OpenAI because he fears AGI, you know, that computers become sentient. What did he say? I just read it today. The world is not ready for artificial general intelligence. And I think if you understand a little bit of the fundamentals of how intelligence works, how machines work, what the statistical fundamentals are on also transformers, I think this is crap, to my opinion. Like, so sorry to say that. Yeah, happy to have discussions in the comments about this. But what's your take on this crystal ball kind of myth around AI?
Yeah, somebody in my team always says AI is just the stuff we can't do yet. And we have had AI for a long time. We use AI every day. It's incredible what, you know, our cell phones can do for us and navigation systems and all of this. It's all very, very clever. And it gets smarter all the time. If you go to China, for example, their equivalent of Maps or Google Maps or whatever, mm-hmm. they're even connected to the traffic light system, you know, so it can be really efficient.
I didn't know that.
So where will it end? And then you get into the, you know, will robots become sentient at some point? And they will. And that starts to introduce a lot of philosophical kind of questions.
Are you really thinking that? Because I'm not so sure, to be honest, because I see that human intelligence is not really understood. There's so much research that we don't know how we fall in love, mm-hmm. how women can give birth, you know, like how intelligence is inherited. Why we wake up at night with some dream, yeah? It's an opinion, yeah? But I don't believe that just by more and more compute, there will be some this inception point where the, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I think clearly a computer will never develop feelings in the sense that we do, but they couldn't behave in the same way you can certainly program them mm-hmm. to behave exactly as Alexander Tam would behave, and we should be able at some point to be able to replicate someone like you and make a robot indistinguishable from you. And then I'm wondering how you would react if I came over and I wanted to switch you off. Yeah, how would the computer react? It'll react the same way as you. So, the capability will be there, but I just don't think people will go in that direction because the one thing that people have always been really good at doing is handling other people. Mm-hmm. Computers are not very good at handling people.
But according to my wife, at least, I often behave very weirdly and not unpredictable. And also I see this in my children that there is no data obviously available for stuff that they come up with, right? Mm-hmm. So, and from the fundamentals of machine learning and also if you know how ChatGPT and everything works, there's no mutation, intuition kind of, you know. But anyways, maybe we're going too far off the topic.
I don't think actually many companies will go in that direction to try to create this sort of thing because there are plenty of people out there and they're there and they can do the things that people do. I think we're going to have at least one generation, maybe two, where people will be working hand in hand with artificial intelligence and neither will work on their own. So doctors will be, you know, working with AI, but the doctor will be taking the final decision, but the AI might be pointing things out and saying, but you need to consider this. I think we'll have that at least for one generation. I think it'll be a very long time before a robot's performing an operation or something.
That's why your opinion, I think, is so valued here, because you have been through this whole development and are still very active, more active than ever maybe, yeah, in the field. And I think a lot of fear and uncertainty comes from people not understanding how ChatGPT, for example, works. Mm. Yeah, I do this in talks all the time that I explain, for example, the basic fundamentals and say it's just a next word prediction and it does that very well based on the context you give it, but it's not understanding what you're saying. Yeah, because also in the media, it you know, I think people are not specific enough with their wording. They say, yeah, the AI now understands your intention or so, you know, and it gives you a better answer, but basically that's not correct. Yeah, and that's why they are so confused about hallucination. How can it hallucinate? Well, it's actually not hallucinating. It's just that the next word then was a wrong prediction, obviously. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but just saying that, I mean, like I think I'm heading to is if more people understood, you know, computers and mathematical fundamentals of what we're doing now, I think there would be less weird decisions, and maybe we would also have an easier interpretation of the AU AI Act.
Yeah. Yes. Don't get me started. I mean, it's... I think there is a level of... If you look at the amount of computing that is around us that we interact with every day, because people are using devices all the time, even if it's just their cell phones, the amount of computer literacy that accompanies it is woefully inadequate. And I think it should start in school. People should be getting an education about IT. How is it? What does it really do? How does it work? There's an astonishing number of people that have got no clue what goes on inside a computer at all, whether it's around storage or how do they do calculations or what programming really is. I think everybody should get exposure to programming when they're at school, because there's virtually no job that you will do after you leave a school where you won't need to have some sort of understanding, especially if you go through a university career, the kind of job you're going to pick up, you do need to understand IT. And, you know, if you're in a marketing department or HR or whatever, I mean, you're using systems all the time. You should at least know what's going on inside them and how they operate. And it would also help people to understand what's possible and what's not.
Yeah, and if stuff breaks or if stuff doesn't behave the way that you are able to fix it. But the question is, like, with the development being so quick, yeah, and with... I don't know, maybe also some weird decisions we have at the moment in terms of elections. Yeah. Do you think, I mean, is this a realistic claim, or will it just be so fast and the tools will be so easy to use that nobody will go back because it's just not an investment that pays off, let's say. And you know what I mean? Like, I guess my question is, like, should we focus on understanding fundamentals and train that at school? Or should we go the other way around and say, well, you know, that's not important anymore. Just learn how to interact as humans, and the technology basically is there anyways. We don't focus on, you know, this mathematical stuff anymore. It's more about art and emotions and about persuasion and human interaction.
Well, we teach people the basics for almost everything at school, but the curriculum hasn't really changed to move with the times. And I remember when I was at school, calculators were starting to come out. They were quite expensive, but they started to arrive in the 70s, 80s. And if you wanted, you could, of course, use a calculator in some of the exams, but there were some things that you had to do without, because people have to understand the basics. You could say, well, you just need to teach people how to use a calculator, and that's enough, because that's what they're going to do. But I think it's kind of useful if people know the basics of arithmetic, so that should, and that still continued to be taught. So I think we've reached the stage where IT is so ubiquitous that people should better understand it. And I meet people all the time who, think of my brother, for example, some of the basic questions he asked me, I mean, because he just doesn't know anything about computing at all. It's really, really basic stuff, like, you know, how do you get an email? The other day, how can I get your emailed ICS files for calendar entries to go into my calendar? He doesn't know how to do this. He's had no education at all in computing ever. He's only 63, but that's how fast things have changed, because 40 years ago, it wasn't a relevant thing, but today it absolutely is. So...
Interesting. So looking a little bit at the current state, how do you see the world has changed, and how do you see that AI is playing a fundamental role, especially in Europe?
I think there's a lot of things that have changed. When I started out, every country in Europe had its own technology companies, all of them. Whether it was Olivetti or Siemens, Nixdorf or ICL, Logica, so many of these companies. Every country had its own Honeywell, Bull, everywhere you went. You couldn't avoid it. And then over time, a lot of the infrastructure suddenly became American infrastructure. So you'd be buying your hardware from companies like IBM, Digital, whatever. And we've now gone to another stage now where the infrastructure is mostly in America, huge amount of it is, and it's almost entirely all operated by American companies. So now the data is also a lot of the time sitting in the US. And I think from a geopolitical perspective, that's a bit of a risk. And we of course, had an election this week, as you know, and we've now got a president who's very clear that he's going to make America great again, and not so interested in how Europe develops. We've got India and China emerging really rapidly as powerful economies with very intelligent workforces. And they are very easy, they're very ready to do business with North American companies and not necessarily see Europe in the mix. Mm-hmm. India and America, from an entrepreneurial perspective, have a lot in common, and they do a lot of work together already. Everybody's got delivery centers in India and in China. And where is Europe in all of this? So mm-hmm. where are the big giants? We've obviously got SAP. There are companies like Deutsche Telekom that are very big as well. But if you actually look at the DAX and look at the big companies that are out there's not that many that mm-hmm. are in the technology sector in Europe. Very few. You see luxury goods companies, Louis Vuitton and so on, Hermes and the like. But it's a little bit worrisome that Europe doesn't really have that. The occasional cloud available, like telecom's got one, but there's not that much there. And things increasingly go more and more to the US. And people talk about the disproportionate amount of wealth that there is in Wall Street, but you actually really need to look at Silicon Valley if you want to see where the money really is. And this is quite a dangerous scenario. And AI is going to make that even more extreme.
Let's go a little bit further. Lovely topics, very, very greatly put up. So I found it. I mean, it's not a secret that at the coast there was a different election behavior than in the center of yes. Or in the rest, not even the center, but the rest, which is not in the coast. So, and then also I just read a study of my friend Carsten Banger of BARC, who they also have a US representancy now, and they figured out that also the AI literacy in America is not better than in Europe. Yeah, so General Motors or all the smaller companies in America also don't have what we would expect if we just look at, you know, Silicon Valley and NVIDIA and the tech companies, who are basically also, as you said, solely pushing MSCI World Index up and everything. So is there already a danger maybe of a disparity in the US? I've seen also this movie Civil War, bad movie by the way, but you have been around the world. I mean, we get to Europe later, but looking at the US now, what will happen? I mean, is this already a problem that they have actually in their own country?
They do. I think we both understand why it is, because a lot of the technology that companies like General Motors have, or Lufthansa, or wherever you want to look at any traditional established company, it tends to be quite old. Mm. And a lot of the companies that have emerged in recent years, you look at Amazon, for example, or there's a lot of intermediaries that have come in, like Booking.com or whatever. They've all got relatively new tech, and they've all built it with data in mind, with artificial intelligence in mind, really good data mining capabilities. So I think a lot of the traditional companies, no matter where they are in the world, has that challenge. If you go to India and China, mm-hmm. IT is relatively new there. It was a yes. horrifically expensive thing in the past. And look at the advanced stage of the Chinese capabilities in the IT space. It's amazing. So I think, yes, there is a challenge inside America as well. But that's where Silicon Valley is. That's where a lot of the thought leadership is. And people tend to move around within their own community. So I think they will get access to the skills a lot easier than, say, Europe will, because mm-hmm. there are just very few places in Europe where people are doing advanced things in the AI space. Mm-hmm. That's why you're doing what you do for a living, and that's why we've created Multiply, because we can see that there's a lot of clients in this geography that absolutely need a lot of help. We have to catch up. But you see it's happening. Companies like Tesla are starting to have a very significant impact on the automotive industry. Mm-hmm. Very significant.
Mm-hmm. So how do you, it's kind of not ridiculous, but interesting, let's say, how this could all happen, right, with the election and the results of that. I mean, like, I think we were not really expecting, then we were like, oh shit, this is really gonna happen now. Yeah, and nobody expected, I think, Donald Trump to win the second time when he first came up. But I don't want to go too deep into that, but looking from a very global, if we were an alien and we look at the ball, yeah, the blue planet, and do you think for Europe now, and maybe also for the rest of the world, is this now a bad or a good thing?
Well,
easy question.
There are a lot of, I think there's a lot of challenges with a lot of world leaders at the moment in many places. If you look at some of the more powerful or dangerous countries in the world, they don't necessarily have leaders that we would choose ourselves. So I think there are some challenges. We've got a couple of military conflicts going on at the moment. Let's just call it like that. Difficult to tell what interventions are going to come with the new leadership that we have. But I've not got a feeling the outcome will be good.
But why are people, I mean, people are somehow, I don't know, they give space to those bullies, let's say. I mean, like, because it's easy to blame the particular people, but we see now, I mean, especially also in this election, all the, I mean, Elon Musk supporting and everything. So I mean, he's also
and giving away millions to people, you know,
so I was just wondering, but I think ultimately there seems to be a need for, I don't know, people who are just bold and authentic, even if it's weird, right?
I think what Donald Trump does remarkably well is he is able to connect with people and sway their opinion. He's able to influence them. He's not conventional. He doesn't do anything that the other politicians typically do. You don't hear him quoting facts very often. When he does, they're usually made up or wrong. But he's actually got a good way of connecting with the people. And I once saw an analysis of a speech that he did, and it was incredible how simple his communication was. He only used one word that had three syllables or more, and that was terrific. And he used it like 17 times out of 1,000 words. And everything was more or less one syllable. It's going to be great. You know, really, really simple. Comes across with a lot of authenticity. And he's pointing a light on what he sees as a broken political system that I think everybody else sees as well. So suddenly he's got a rhetoric that resonates with the man in the street. So as you said, if you look at the blue versus the red map of North America, it's a very interesting distribution of where people are voting Republican versus for the Democratic Party. But he's been able to sway volumes of people. And I'm not actually sure that I've understood what the value proposition is for those guys that are voting for him that will make them vote for him, that he's doing it. And maybe they're just fed up with conventional politics. It's hard to say. But the polls up until, you know, Monday were predicting that Kamala Harris was still in the lead. And that's not what happened on polling day.
And it was pretty clear, actually, right? It was not a super close race.
No, it's not close at all.
So
nobody's asking for a recount or challenging it like the last time. So, but he's resonating with the man in the street.
I think so as well. I think, and it's also, it's just, he's giving people this idea of security in a very uncertain world, let's say, right? And I see similar happening because, I mean, it's always easy to blame those the head of the snake, but there's the whole structure behind that somehow supporting that. So do you think we are... I just heard someone saying we are at the end of an S-curve, right? So, and people are feeling that we talked about this new normal, or with the pandemic, everything was different, obviously. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you had something that you could blame or that you could take as a reason, right? You cannot leave your house because there's some pandemic obviously going on. And I think everybody was expecting that there will be this new normal, but it never really went back to some kind of steady state, right? Is that what you feel, or
what definitely,
is your take on that?
We're definitely there are a lot of differences that came because of the pandemic. And one thing I've noticed is people are rather blasé about whether they actually go to the office or not. I mean, I'm an old man. For 38 years, going to the office every day was normal. Of course, the pandemic arrived. I coped with that quite well because I was in a global role, so I was used to either being with Lufthansa or being at home. I didn't have a regular office to go to every day. I was either in, you know, Beijing or Sydney or whatever, or I was at home. But I've noticed that a lot of people don't want to go back, and a lot of people like the benefit of that. Of course, it made a lot of changes to how people work because we, certainly when I was at Accenture, we saw a big swing in terms of two things. One was the willingness to be in the cloud because it turned out the cloud was more stable during the pandemic because it was difficult keeping their own data centers running. And the second thing was a big swing towards offshore because all the people that said it doesn't work working remote learned that it did. So we saw a massive surge at that time in both offshore and the cloud business. And I think the pandemic kind of fueled that. But a lot of things have not gone back the way they were before. And yeah, I see it with a lot of my clients today. You say, oh, I'll come into the office and see you, and they say, oh, I won't be in that day.
You want to go back to the clients, but the clients are not there, right?
Yeah.
So I can travel and again, visit clients, but no, but you go, I go. I mean, now some are changing that with their rules to people have to be in the office at least like 3 days a week or so. Yeah, but if you go to, I don't know, BMW on a Monday or so,
you might be alone.
You're quite alone. So makes it hard for salespeople as well. Yeah,
And you can't walk the halls the same, you know. So if you're on a project, you know, I was at the Deutsche Bahn, as I told you, for 13 years or something. A lot of the business was done because you met somebody at the coffee machine.
Exactly.
You know, you start talking, oh, you're working on a project, we can help you with that. Oh, can you? Oh, why don't you come back, show me what you can do?
Yes.
That's how business gets done.
Yeah, and also collaboration that happens accidentally. Yeah, so, but okay, so what do you think, I mean, what was the motivation to, I mean, I think maybe you didn't do it for the money, I don't know, yeah, but so what was the motivation to, after so much achievement and looking back on a obviously fruitful life with family, I think you have four kids. So why did you not take a nice chair in some, I don't know, it would be south of Spain or whatever would be here?
Well, I think what happened was when I got towards the end of my time at Accenture, and Accenture were kind enough to offer me earlier retirement, which they often do for people above 55 if they're at level one. That's very common. I continued doing client work, which was unusual. Most people would just say, hey, I get 6 months of doing nothing, because, of course, they put you on a kind of garden leave where they don't want you working, competing with them. And I kept doing the client stuff, and that worked quite well. It was an odd request. I think it was the first one that asked to keep doing it because I wanted to stay active. So I got a lot of time to myself because that was maybe only a third of my time or something. And in that time, I kind of got a bit bored. Not initially, but after about 6 months, I was getting a bit bored. And in parallel, a friend of mine has his own consultancy company and was interested in me helping him build out the business in Germany, which they tried many times and couldn't really do. But we sort of came to disagreement, shall we say, or crossed swords on a few topics where I felt that we had to do things differently. To cut a long story short, that got me into the mood of going back and doing something, but always believed that I could do something on my own. Mm-hmm. And I was talking with Holger at that time, because Holger was also in discussions to help build that German business. Holger was saying, you know, I believe that we'll get a big tailwind if we join an established business. They'll have a team of clients, they'll have some contracts already. Everybody's got a footprint in Germany. They've got a team of people, which is big, 600-700 people. We can tap into that. It'll be much easier. And I always said, I believe in you and I believe in some others as well that we would be able to do it. So we did it. It has been easier, I would say, because every client we're talking to is open and saying, yeah, we do have some challenges. Yes, you can help. And we like the idea of very senior talent coming, but not insisting that we take a big pyramid of people, which is the model I was used to in Accenture.
Yeah, sure.
Clients
yeah.
buy pyramids. So that was the rationale. And I'm finding it very interesting because you've been through this yourself. If you don't have a boss, and you can just decide stuff right there and then in front of the client, whatever it might be, and you don't have to worry about an approval process, it's just much more enjoyable and it's more successful because, you know, I know what the right thing is. I can figure that out for myself. I don't need to go through an approval process, but corporations have to have processes and checks and balances. Nobody's asked me to do stuff that I think is a waste of time. You do get that in big companies. I don't have that anymore. And if I decide I just want to promote somebody in the team, I don't have to wait for a promotion cycle. I just go ahead and do it or reward somebody, give them a bonus, whatever. And there's nobody I need to talk to. And what I'm trying to do is to create the best place for the best people. So we're hiring people of an extremely high caliber and we're trying to make it a very pleasant environment, but they're going to have to work hard because it's very much a clients first and, you know, and take care of the people mode that we're in. And that's not for free. So you have to put your sleeves up and your head down. But so far, it's extremely rewarding and the people are really happy. So I'm getting a massive kick out of it and I'm actually working a lot more than I planned to.
You've probably seen that. I see that. And I also know most of your team now, which is amazing. I mean, it's funny, like, it reminds me a little bit of when I started, because then the more you grow the company, you're more and more have to have those policies like a high, like a promotions circle, because otherwise it gets more chaotic. So it's interesting that also we now with like 500-ish people have to adapt more to some stuff that other consultants were always doing that I felt annoyed with. So it's funny to go to those cycles. But you said something which is really true. And I think you're obviously insanely successful in your life. Yeah. I think to a certain point, you can just do that if you have some balance, if you balance your family, your health, all the other things, because otherwise just with hard work and with, you know, very warrior kind of push, you get to a certain point and you don't get further. Or, I mean, even if you are blessed with a great body and everything, and a good health, but still at this point where you cannot scale, the dancing bear, yeah. The dancing bear cannot dance more than 24 hours, 7 days a week for 20 years, let's say, yeah. So I think you already have this balance, and then I think it becomes also a lifestyle. And once you're like a sports kind of, you know, like an athlete, if you go down to zero, then it's not healthy at all. And maybe you also figure that it's not the achievement or the goal; it's the progress or the process, right? So, and that's also because why I never sold AT, yeah, because I didn't know what else to do, right? And it's obviously
you told me that a few times.
No, it's like it's. I mean, obviously, it's very cool, and I was always by all of you guys, also Frank Riemensperger and everybody was super humble, and I never felt like. You know, like the smaller, partner in such a negotiation. But I think that's very necessary to make the post-merger integration also possible. Yeah, which obviously also not always works. But I played with the idea and I talked to people who went through this progress. You know, I'm a Tony Robbins fan, and I met people there who basically, you know, were in some kind of change in their life, and they were doing sailing around the world or whatever, big race driving or whatever, you know, stuff that you always wanted to do and maybe never had the time. But then it comes back to if this would have been so very important for you to be happy sailing the world, you would have done it already mm-hmm. before, right? So basically, and even if it's subliminally, you made the choice to live that way. Yeah. And also a lot of people, they think that they can have the same success again. And maybe they have some hubris about themselves, and they underestimate also that there was some timing that played a role. So I'm super humble with that, because I don't see myself as a serial entrepreneur. I've had like two or three businesses fail before I started AT, and it was also not a huge risk taking, because it was a service business. So I didn't put all my money into some product and waited 3 years and hope that would work. It was already profitable. So I don't know. And I saw a lot of people who were then not so happy after being
acquired.
Yeah. And then privatier, or how you say that in English.
No, I can tell you that 9 times out of 10, the owner will leave within 3 years.
Mm.
Virtually every acquisition, they go. And if I think of the ones that I was involved in at Accenture, even in the DACH region, I'm thinking of them all. The owners have all left. And I think it's because it's too big a change for them. And if you're the owner, you're deciding everything every day, and the people can come to you if there's a problem, and you can solve it immediately because you don't have to decide with anybody else. But if it's an organization with 800,000 people, there's going to be at least three dimensions trying to manage the business. And I think you'd come in and you just wouldn't really know for a long time who you need to talk to get things done. So, you know, companies like Accenture would give a deal shepherd and a deal sponsor to stay really close to the founders to try and help them through this process. But ultimately they go. They all go. It's very rare for them to stay. And often when they do stay, they pick up another role entirely somewhere else in the organization, and they just let the rest of the machine get on with what they had built up over the years. So I think you should only really sell if you really intend that you step out and do something else, because the change is just too much. And there's nothing wrong with a company like Accenture. It's a fantastic place.
I think they do a great job.
I was there for 31 years and I loved it. It's the best decision I ever made in my life was to join Accenture. Second best decision was to come to Germany, because that worked out really well for me. It's not as advanced in IT as some other parts of the world. America is much further ahead. The UK was definitely further ahead. It was a primary industry to go into. But, you know, in this geography, people want to go into, you know, engineering. You know, there's a lot of great manufacturing companies, a superb automotive industry, a lot of big pharmaceutical, chemical companies. There's a lot of real businesses as opposed to IT, which is supporting those businesses. So that was a great thing for me to come here, because I suddenly realized I had a lot of skills that were quite rare here.
So. That's so interesting. Maybe let's tap into that as well. Once we talked about entrepreneurship and being a large and medium and small corporates. I told you about meeting Peter Diamandis once, and I asked him about what I could do better in Europe to convince people about data and AI. It was like 5 years ago. I think
he wouldn't know how to do it in Europe.
He
would tell you to go to Silicon Valley.
Exactly. That's what he did. Yeah. I was figuring that he would tell me you have to tell this story or that's how you influence people or that this trick. And if you're in a room or whatever, it would be some NLP stuff or so. Yeah. Not the natural language portion, but the neuro-linguistic programming. But he said, yeah, Alex seemed to be a nice guy, come to the Silicon Valley, you know.
Where did you meet him? Was this the Singularity University or something?
No, it was on a Tony Robbins event actually in Sun Valley.
Was he presenting?
Finance. Yeah, he was one of the presenters. He did a great presentation about AI, very well put together for non-tech people, let's say. Yep. Yeah, and there was some billionaires in the room. Ray Dalio was also in a call and was great. It was right before the pandemic, and there was one guy.
Did he have Ray Kurzweil with him?
No.
No. The guy that invented the keyboards.
But it was just funny. It was one guy, I think, was it Harvey Dent? We have to look it up. Sorry, we put it in the notes. And he was always saying, he was always like the doomsday man. He would always say but we're end of all cycles and there would be a huge crisis coming up. And it was February 20 or when was the pandemic? It was 20,
February,
right?
2020. I was one of the first guys that got COVID.
Exactly. And it was in February in Sun Valley. It was super cold there. Everybody was coughing. We thought, okay, it's the cold air, you know. And then this was the first time he was actually right, because he used to say this every year, obviously, on this occasion, that there will be the end of those cycles. But what I wanted to head to was... I felt a little bit like in the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, in the biography event, because then everybody was clapping like, yeah, Alex from Germany, come to the US, you know, and you have a huge success and American dream, everything. And I felt totally, enthusiastic and yes, oh, cool, thank you. Well, little Alex, you know, from Germany and East Germany even. But then I got really sad. I was like, yeah, but, you know, I love America. I love Silicon Valley and California, skiing, snowboarding is amazing, and other places as well. I've been there. I love Vegas and I love that. Yeah. But I also like it here, and I figured but I didn't want to go. Right. So why can't we make this happen here? And,
you are making it happen here.
Yeah, sure. But
there's a lot to do still.
So I was just reflecting on what you said. So why do you say it was your second best choice to go to Germany? Why are you still in Germany?
Career-wise was what I meant. I was only talking about my career.
Okay.
It was a good place to come, because I worked for a number of clients here. The Deutsche Bahn was, for me, a great experience, because they're actually quite a humble organization internally.
Yes.
They were quite good at IT delivery, much better than they think they are. Mostly they were hitting the deadlines. And I've worked for a lot of other industries like banking and insurance, which missing deadlines is quite common. But the band were actually quite good at it. And it was a very humbling process. They were always happy to accept you. They were always keen to get help. So I really enjoyed that. And we built some massive, massive systems for them. Very, very big projects. And I was still learning, of course, there. That was a super time. I was maybe 10 years out of college at that point. So for me, that was super. And I found Accenture extremely welcoming in Germany. They welcomed me into the team. They gave me management roles very early on, even though I was still technically a member of the UK. They heavily supported my promotion to both what was associate partner then and then equity partner in 2000, which I thought was great, because they had their own people. They didn't have to support me so hard. And as part of that, that made me move to Germany permanently, because you have to belong to a partnership somewhere. Mm-hmm. And it was the German partnership that was offering me the slot. And I just loved it, because I always got very good opportunities. I met Frank Riemensberger, who's, you know, one of the smartest guys yes. you can meet. And him and I were always a great counterweight to mm-hmm. each other. He would have more radical ideas. I would be the one putting my foot on the brake sometimes. And it's kind of the opposite way around at the moment. It's interesting.
I was
to
just
see
saying,
how it's changed.
I figured the other way around.
yeah, but we always worked really well together. And we helped each other a lot with both of our careers. We had often roles that were close to each other. But the team in general was fantastic. And I like, there's something I like about Germany as well. The German work ethic is really good, especially in Accenture, where everybody works extremely hard and multiplies. It's a very similar thing, but harder, and I would say with a higher quality bar that we're setting. People come in the morning and they get to work pretty quickly. They don't hang around the coffee machine for long, their heads down. I was just overwhelmed by the work ethic of everybody. Even back in 96 when I arrived, the very first assistant that I got, she was fantastic. Really taking everything extremely seriously and doing things very professionally. Same with the next assistant I got. And my current assistant I've had for almost 20 years, she's joined as a multiplier. Super. Very great work ethic. Everybody takes the client seriously and everybody takes the work seriously.
I totally.
And I love that.
It's funny that you say that. I really feel you, because when I was first, I was doing an internship in Sacramento, and I was showing up in a suit, yeah, and I was with a host there, and he had a very shady, rundown old pickup Toyota truck, and they would, you know, stop at some place to get two liter big gulp Coca-Cola, and then they would go somewhere else, and then it was like, hey guys, what you know, what's happening, yeah, and then they would tell me to go home because I wanted to stay longer, to go skiing in Lake Tahoe, and then maybe finish Friday earlier. And I was making over hours and had a lot of fun, and also felt I could have a great impact. So I think on this worker kind of level, let's say, yeah, I totally agree with you. The question is, what is missing on the larger perspective, or on the collaboration, or why is this work ethic on a particular single person level obviously not paying out on that global level anymore? Do you know what I mean, or does it make sense?
By global, do you mean worldwide, or do you mean overall?
In comparison to if you compare the outcome that we have, the GDP, the valuation that our companies get, so it seems to be like this work ethic on. I mean, also like Americans love to hire Germans as well, right? So it seems to be working on this personal level of work ethic, but somehow it doesn't seem to scale into evaluation of the corporations anymore.
I mean, the automotive sector is going through an interesting cycle at the moment, because there's a transition to electrical vehicles, and there's a lot more software going into the vehicles. It's quite a different driving experience that people are looking for compared to what they used to. So there's a lot of investments moving into some of the newer companies. So the valuations are lower than they probably ought to be. That I have seen. You got me thinking, though, because one of the things I observed inside Accenture was very, very few Germans made it to the top of the company. If you went to the people in global roles, there was only a few that got there. I was one of them, but I wasn't a German. I was in a big global role, but you'd see a lot of Spanish, a lot of French, a lot of Italians. They're sort of everywhere, and they're great to work with. But very few of the Germans would get into big global roles. We had one very notable example in Accenture, who became the head of the sort of systems integration business globally, and subsequently the global head of strategy. So I'm curious as to what it might be. I mean, the products are there. The GDP is kind of strong, but the people like to work slightly less hours in Germany, I would say, than in other parts of the world. Let's just say it like that. But it's a good question. I mean, you've got, like I say, you've got SAP is up there with quite a good valuation. Telecom's doing really, really well at the moment. Probably telecom's got a higher valuation than the next four or five European telcos put together. I mean, it's
quite something. But also because of their US business, right, mostly?
Well, their US business is really, really big. And I learned that when I was in Accenture, because I had the T-Mobile North America account was, a lot of it was digital, so it rolled up to me, and I was quite astonished by how much business Accenture were doing for T-Mobile in North America, and it's run as a separate business as well. So they don't drive it locally, but they are very successful there.
But I think this is some and we continue to the next topic. Yeah, but I found this. I think we need in Europe. I mean, now we are left alone. Let's say I think there will not be much help on military stuff, which it's kind of the question I had. Like, you know, like is this now the ultimate kick in the butt for us in Europe that there's. If Donald Trump maybe won't help us with some of the issues because he's basically caring about America. And I mean, maybe that's not a very global view, and maybe it's not a modern view, and maybe the way he's doing that and the person as a convicted criminal, you know, this is something, I mean, that's obviously for us very weird. But saying, well, we have some problems to fix in our own country and I'm the one handling that, I think it's a very good proposition towards the citizen. Yeah, I mean, citizens there. So, and I'm missing that in Europe, and I'm not saying that some AfD stuff or something. I'm just saying that, well, what is our take? What is our vision? What is our USP? Yeah, like you would set up a company. If we start a data AI company, so what's my take? Who are my partners I want to get together with? What am I telling my clients where they should hire me above everyone else? And I think we don't have that value proposition in Europe, and nobody's actually also responsible for that, right? We just know what we are afraid of, and we regulate. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you said very well. By the way, I quoted you many times already. Yeah, China duplicates, America innovates, and Europe tends to regulate. Yeah. So what would you wish for as a seasoned European, let's say, that has to change now? And
I mean, we have the European Union has been a good thing for bringing peace to Europe. I mean, Europe never had peace before the European Union mm-hmm. was established. And we've had a lot of it. It depends what you call Europe, of course. But there had been a lot in the past that we don't need to go in. But every country started wars with every other one, you know. And it's only really been the last, 50, 60, 70 years where we've actually enjoyed a lot of peace in Europe. And it's been good for everybody. But it is a very bureaucratic organization. Mm. And very, very heavy with everything. What I'm missing is, there's not enough entrepreneurship anyway. And, you know, you meet an awful lot of entrepreneurial Chinese people or Indian people or American people, but it's not a thing in Europe to the same extent. So that's part of the problem. But we need to start doing some things, I think, much more strategically. And I think the last time something really strategic was done was probably the formation of Airbus. You know, when really something entrepreneurial was done to take on Boeing, who seemed to be unstoppable 40 years ago, and Airbus has been a tremendously successful venture. So why are we not doing something in the IT space? It's going to become a serious risk if all of your data is sitting somewhere else. And I've met board members in Germany who have said they know that competitors in America have got access to their data.
It's
happening.
And also with this data stored in Europe by American companies or so, this is a hoax, actually, because you know that in all the routers, there's already backdoors built in. I mean, the NSA was spying on Angela Merkel. Yeah, so I think this is... But this is just how the world functions, right? I mean, and also the funny thing is that we are relying a lot on American intelligence services and for our own security as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, some of the bad stuff that was prevented was actually because, you know, there was information coming over from abroad.
Oh, I know. They know an awful lot.
And, you know, maybe too much, but anyway,
they know a lot, an awful lot.
I mean, and you don't need to answer that. Yeah, we didn't talk about this before, but do you really believe in a fair chance of Europe?
I think yes. I think because intrinsically we've got a lot of the right ingredients. There are some demographic trends that are. We see birth rates coming down. We've got a lot of immigration happening, so a lot of people coming into the country that may or may not have the same level of education. So there are some challenges on the way. That's the European thing overall. But we've got the fundaments there. We've got good universities,
that's right,
good schooling system. Mm-hmm. I still think it's a better place to live for me than the US, because let's face it, the US diverts money into military projects when the money could be going into a health service that was taking care of their people. It makes them a very powerful nation militarily, which allows them to do things and intervene in situations where otherwise they wouldn't. But we've been slack in Europe. We've allowed NATO to become weaker and weaker. We used to be very strong militarily. We're not anymore. I think there can be threats on our doorstep if America were to leave us entirely on our own.
That's also something I cannot, and I'm not politically smart, let's say, or educated, but what I don't understand, if you make a decision to put like 4% of your GDP into military expenses, and we just don't do it, right? No. And this is funny because that we get away with it. I mean, like, then I think we have two choices, and follow the stuff that we agreed upon, or vote against it, or change the policy, but not that just don't deliver, right? So, and that's for me, this is super weird. Like, a company would never function if there's decisions on the board, and then people just don't do it and they get away with it. I mean, that's
and dysfunctional Trump system. Rightly brought this up.
And he's right.
In his previous term.
Yeah, NATO. Maybe one fact he got right, but...
but he was absolutely right, and I think... I think it is bad that we depend on other people for our defence. I mean, of course, there are a couple of countries that have got nuclear weapons, which, you know, stops something really strategic happening. But if that's all you've got, it's either you use them or you don't use them, and it's a big step to use them. Because a nuclear war, you know, can never be won and should never be fought.
Yeah, that's a whole different topic. So, okay.
That's the key thing that we have. And unfortunately, so I think we will have to invest in some of these things. But I would like to see more more leadership in the information technology space. And it can't be done through a bunch of bureaucrats and politicians. It needs to be something that's invested in strategically. Get proper thought leaders on board, people that really know what they're doing. And where's the next Airbus in the IT space? I'd love to see that.
The problem is, I think, the federalism. Yeah, I'm a fan of our Bavarian digital minister. Yeah, and he said, well, if he wants to change something or have a decision, he needs to talk already to 2,000 communities. And if you put this further you have the state level, you have the country level. But anyways, I mean, this is something, and we tried with Gaia X and those efforts to do that, maybe the wrong way. I'm not so sure. I think it has to get even worse until people wake up. But because there's so many news coming up, I also believe, I mean, that's why I bought property here and not somewhere else, and I'm also raising my family here, obviously. I think with that's what I love also about our collaboration is the topic of data and AI, because I think this is one of the chances that can actually switch a little bit. Also when talking to Jensen of NVIDIA, he was here. I met him last year and he said, well, you know, you guys have something that others don't, which is this industry and the data that's coming from your industrial processes during the last, 100 years. And this could be used to inform AI that is not available to some consumer AI, let's say, or they can be trained with internet information because it's company-specific, domain-specific data. So I hope that we could have this entrepreneurship. But I agree, and that's why I love about your attitude and how you built your company now, that they have to have this hunger. And even if you have achieved a lot and everything that everybody would say, why don't you lay down? You still have this hunger, and not for yourself, but if you believe that you can have an impact. And I want to, why is not everybody like that? Right? So going to the future maybe a little bit, what do you expect in the field of IT, data and AI to happen in the next, let's say, 5 years? 10 years is maybe too far away, but... What are you betting on, or what do you think are some stuff to watch out for?
Well, I think it's going to become. I mean, it's table stakes in the future. If you've not got a data driven business, you're going to find it difficult to compete because there are too many companies out there that are exactly like that. They're using data to drive their business, and quite often let other people do the heavy lifting. And if you look at something, for example, like the revenue growth that Amazon had last year, it's phenomenal, unimaginable if you were trying to do this all by yourself. They're using data, they're using technology in a very clever way. And somebody once told me, by the way, that they can't actually run Amazon.com on Amazon Web Services entirely. somebody told me they had to run part of it in a very proprietary landscape. Okay. So somebody once told me that. I don't know if it's still true. But what they've done is remarkable. And, you know, companies are, I mean, obviously, this has hit the retail sector immensely.
Yes.
It's really been a big shake-up. And I think we're going to see more and more organizations winning when they're using AI in a totally differentiated way to better understand their customers, better understand their partners, their citizens, their supply chains. You'll see a big impact because AI is going to be everywhere. And if anybody who doesn't go down that path, well, frankly, they'll just be missing a trick. They're not firing on all cylinders. They'll be doing things the difficult way. And I think people often expect absolutes with AI. And why I keep saying, I think for the next couple of generations, we're going to be working hand in hand with AI is because you can't rely on it completely. Some people do follow the navigation instructions by the book and end up driving into rivers and things like this. But most of us look at the Navi screen and say, oh, that can't be right. And you know, most of the time it's right, but sometimes there's an issue and it's not right. And you double check on another app.
Exactly.
So I think people are very used to it. We all accept that Amazon recommend we buy a product that not only have we bought before, we bought it from Amazon, we just accept it, but they're still very good at making suggestions and things that you might want to have. And I used to joke that my wife said to me one year, we shouldn't buy Christmas presents for each other anymore because we're not very good at it. And within an hour, I got an email from Amazon listing five things, four of which I wanted to have. and I used to joke that, you know, the reason that Amazon is doing that is because they're still listening to me.
Yeah,
that's, and my wife is not.
That's a myth. Yeah.
But there are a lot of these companies out there though that are embracing it, and they're gambling a bit. They're taking risks. They're taking chances. In this geography, people don't like making mistakes. People want to get things perfect. People want to get things right. I think we have to gamble a little bit more, because the users are quite used to getting emails that are irrelevant or getting suggestions that are not relevant. But at the same time, they still act on the ones that are relevant. So why not? So I think this is the big change that we're going to see. A lot of companies are just going to struggle. And I think some of them already are. There are some companies out there where you can say the wheel is still spinning, but the hamster is dead.
That's, I haven't heard that before. Yeah, we see it now in the automotive industry, right? And it was it's funny because it's like 10 years, 15 years where you have this in the board meetings and you have labs building stuff and then it's ultimately happening and then it's still a surprise, right? So I'm personally very bullish about the whole agentic development, right? Because I think this feels a little bit unfair. Like when we started with data science, there were a lot of companies who were already established in the field of business intelligence, and there was basically the work that we did this time was pretty similar. Yeah, we need to talk to people to understand the business value and the business process. We needed to curate the data, which is basically 70% of the work. But then we had always the mindset and the paradigm that we want to do something which is predictive. We want to do something which is not just a dashboard that shows you the past or a report, but something that is towards some prediction that we anticipate more.
Yes.
Yeah. And I remember one discussion I had with a client and he said, yeah, Alex, but I cannot handle tomorrow's problems. I have so many current problems I need to solve. I was like, yeah, well, maybe, but this strategy will never get you out of your misery.
Well, you've done something I haven't done, because at least you've stayed true to yourself and kept on a very solid mission, because I'm finding clients doing exactly the same. I turn up and I want to talk to them about data and artificial intelligence, and they say, oh, that's great, Jack, but can you help me stabilize this thing over here, or can you help me turn around this regular delivery project? I'm a delivery guy, so I'm used to that. So as a consequence, we've got multiple service lines now inside Multiply, not just data and AI. But I think the one that's most exciting is going to be the everything that can be done by making sense of the data. And as you said, this curation issue is the big one. It's at least 70% of the work. And that's why a lot of the new companies are actually okay, because they've started with fresh tech. Amazon captures an awful lot of information without even knowing what they want to do with it. And then later on, they've got an idea and the data's all there, so they can just go and harvest it.
But they're like this example. I mean, and even I know that, for example, at Zalando or so, they already have also some legacy. So they also get to the stage. But what I was heading to is that the reason why we were able to grow and was basically this mindset in terms of data science first before BI. And now I see something similar happen with agentic AI or with agents, where I'm still in the place of machine learning. And I say, well, like in terms of we have to, you know, have a lot of data and test for statistical hypotheses on what predictive algorithms you might use. And I see those U-shirt learning models and new approaches. And also this idea of having some mesh in terms of agents in your company, because I always wanted to have this AI business app store. I maybe told you once, yeah, but it never really worked out. So I totally see now with this agentic AI approach, something that even smaller companies could easily embrace. And yes, they would it would be nice, as we talked before, if they knew the fundamentals on how that works. But on the other hand, for them, it's easy applicable. And I think also with Apple Intelligence, once we have it in Europe, yeah, let's hope for that ultimately sometime. It will push the consumer literacy in terms of AI, because they will make it very easy to use in all of their gadgets and all of their products that they have and software. So AI will be more deeply integrated in our world. And I think this will resonate in a push towards our business world, because you want to have the same stuff that we use in private life and our business life. So the push will also come from the from the workforce, because I mean, once when we in talks, you know, if we go to clients, we always are more in this ambassador kind of role. Like, we have to, you have to use data and AI, because otherwise you will not survive the future, you know, and it is actually the future, but it's always you have to push. Yeah. And I think the reason how ChatGPT was so successful was because it was a pull. Yeah, the 100 million users in a week or so would not have been possible with even the best marketing campaign ever. And so I think I would be interested in your take, having been with clients such a long time. Yeah, do you see the future for Europe, and especially for the small and medium companies, to adopt AI another way, as we have tried in the past, let's say?
I think I do see already a lot of small companies. They're very happy to just use ChatGPT for things. We use ChatGPT for things like writing letters to clients and proposals and all of these kind of things. So we're starting to use these things. I think the curation issue is the biggest one that stops big companies really embracing AI. And it's often the case that when I talk to senior clients, especially board members or CEOs, and you talk about their strategy overall, how is their business strategy being impacted by data and AI, and they haven't got an answer.
Yeah.
They say things like, we're going to get more value out of the data, we're going to monetize, and it's like, but how are you going to do this? What are the use cases? Have you really thought about it? Yeah, I've got some people looking into it. But if it's not a board topic where the board is all fully informed about how their strategy will change just because of the arrival of data and AI, how would that be? So I'm dealing with a client at the moment who there's an opportunity for data and AI that they're not even embracing. They can actually be using AI to help them get better results. I don't want to mention the client, but they could easily use AI to get better results in the diagnostics that they have to do. They're not even looking at it. And I'm thinking, this is a no-brainer. The technology's there. If you're able to teach it, just educate it through machine learning. Every time you make some sort of diagnosis based on the information that's available, it will learn and it will come back and say, you might have missed something. There could be a problem here. I mean, I know an elevator company, for example, that knows exactly the sound that a motor will make shortly before it fails. So they're starting to, try and avoid that people get stuck in an elevator with a broken motor, so they can get there quicker. But it's everywhere, and if it's not a board topic, it's not going to make it down through the organization, because otherwise what you have is somebody in the organization going to ask for a budget to do something and somebody saying, we haven't got money for that. Well, you would if it was strategic. There would be money available, and then you would start to change some of these things. So it's a board topic, and I've seen all this for the last 10 years when I was in my role in digital. If the board didn't get it, you would just have problems further down, because the young people get it. The workforce won't have a problem with it. The guys coming out of college are fine. They get it. They understand it. They'll do it. And you've got the permafrost in the middle of the management layer. So if it's not coming down heavy from above, it's not going to make it through the organization. And then everything's going to be rather tactical. And I mean, you've probably seen dozens of clients that have loads of prototypes and POCs and so on, but they haven't really got something up and running as a full operation that's harvesting the results of data and AI, because it's going to be a big human activity as well. You get the results in from the AI, and then you act on it in the business, start phoning clients, suppliers, managing things like that. And it's that's the biggest thing that's got to be cracked. But I'm seeing more of it. I'm getting clients, senior clients coming to me and asking, can you help source very senior people in the data and AI space to where they want to pay really big salaries? But the problem is finding them in Europe is not so easy.
Mm.
And there's not many people in California that are, you know, desperate to come to Germany.
Maybe that will change with the new president.
Well, that could be the case. or what might happen in the future, I wouldn't rule out the Californians wanting to spin off, because California, if it was a standalone country, would be the sixth biggest economy in the world.
Oh, yeah. That's also interesting. Yeah, that's back to the civil war. So thank you very much. So we've been through a whole journey of 30, 40 years of IT from first steps in... leveraging AI for security and counterterrorism, and your whole story being one of the, like, level one is the highest level you can get at Accenture.
Yeah, Accenture is 14 levels.
Wow. And,
so I was level one from 2012 onwards.
Wow, that's it's funny. It's like in judo, right? So if you get the black belt, you're a partner, but then you're there at another 7 or 8 dance you can get, right? So amazing, and just so honored to have you here. Yeah,
of course, always a pleasure.
Your whole journey of huge projects internationally, then also now founding your own company, and then also the impact of Europe. Now we have a change in politics, definitely, again, around the world. And I think we both agree on this topic that all of those companies need to embrace data and AI. And in the end, now you said something, I think, very crucial. And it's so simple, but so it's in the end, it's really the fish stinks from the head. I don't know if you say that in English. Yeah.
At least I'm saying it in English now.
Okay, so fish stinks vom Kopf, sagen wir, yeah. Okay. So it's nice to hear this from you. I always also figured that if the permafrost, as you said, the middle management, the Lärmschicht, I mean, those guys end up under pressure from both sides, let's say. Sometimes I feel that it's their fault that AI gets not adopted in such a larger... to such a larger extent, but you think then there's not enough effort from the top level to help them to establish AI. Is that correct? Or
I think it's just at this stage not enough understanding and not enough investment, not enough drive. It needs to be a really important part of every business strategy.
So if there's anyone out there, medium-sized company doing something, some great hardware stuff, whatever that would be, so and then they now see this and they're interested, how can they get engaged, or how can you help them? How would that work?
I just pick up the phone and we start from there. No, I'd be very, very happy to help. I've seen a lot over the last 40 years. I've seen a lot of things go well. I've seen a lot of things go horribly wrong. And I can see a definite need for change in Europe, and we're building a firecracker team of people to address these challenges. So, and we're hiring. We're looking for good people everywhere. So, pick up the phone, let me know, and we can start to talk. And, of course, we have our partnership, so we can do it together.
I think that's the cool thing. I mean, we bring a little bit more the deep tech expertise and also maybe some ideas for top management, but with your expertise and also your network and also the...
Yeah, you saw yesterday how quickly we can find talent.
Oh, that was awesome.
What, 2 hours?
That was awesome, yeah.
Two great people, within 2 hours we can do this.
And we had some interesting meetings already with some DAX executives where it was just amazing. So, I'm very proud that we could be a partner, and thanks for your effort. Thanks for not being in a lounge chair and helping in Europe and staying here as well. And I'm very grateful. And then obviously
I'm staying in Germany. We decided that long ago.
And for our seasoned podcast members, you already know this, yeah. So also for you, you get one of our symbols, the
DeLorean.
DeLorean, yes, to bring home. I think your children are already too old. Do you have to keep it yourself?
Well, my boys are 21 now, so I'll keep it for myself.
Thanks, Jack. Thanks for being here. I think we took way, way longer than expected.
I'm a bit of a plodder, Tasha. That happens.
Thank you, Jack.
My pleasure.